almost 20 people get killed for politically motivated reasons in Colombia.
People's things are slowly getting better, or at least people think they're getting better, and that's, I think it's good as long people don't forget or ignore what's the problems we have and the problems we must overcome.
Medellin internationally has this horrible image of violence and paramilitary groups and urban militias, but maybe it would help them if they knew what Medellin was like.
But what is going on in Medellin is a very positive process, because what it can change is the imagination, the imagery of the people, and actually have people start appreciating what a culture of legality can bring to their life. And that might bring a cultural change over time, and that therefore you can have a change of attitude, where actually mafia boss, the drug trafficker, is not anymore a hero, but someone actually that you have to stay away from.
The possibility to create using our own stories, using our own wounds, is what art has always offered human beings.
Medellin. It's not an easy word to pronounce for English speakers. And for most of the 20th century, it wasn't an easy place to live either. Colombia's second largest city is synonymous with drug trafficking, with the Medellin cartel led by Pablo Escobar, and it's also synonymous with violence. In 1991, the city recorded 6,349 homicides, more than 11 times that of Chicago. In fact, in the 80s and 90s, Medellin was probably the most violent city in the world. From 1989 to 1993, car bombs made monthly headlines in the local papers. The city was consumed by street battles and kidnappings, the drug cartel versus the government, the Marxist guerrillas versus the paramilitaries, and the dozens of gangs that competed for turf in the city's hillside slums. Almost all of it was either financed by cocaine or related to it. I'm David Sasaki, Director of Outreach for Global Voices. This week we turn our sights to Medellin. In this first part of a two-part podcast, we'll learn how Medellin has transformed itself from one of the world's most dangerous cities to one of Latin America's safest. In part two, we'll focus on the Rising Voices project, Hiper Barrio, which is taking the tools of citizen media to Medellin's hillside slums. Héctor Aristizabal is a native of the city. He survived its violence as a young person. He buried most of his friends that he grew up playing soccer with, and in 1982 he was taken into custody by Colombian soldiers and tortured.
When I grew up in Medellin, it was a very violent city, which unfortunately it still is for many people. I saw the birth of the power of the mafia and the birth of the paramilitary death squads, as well as the ongoing conflict between the guerrilla groups and the Colombian military. During my life in Colombia, the 29 years that I lived there, this was a daily occurrence that someone was killed, someone was kidnapped, someone was tortured, and many of the people were burned. Even my own brother was, in 1999, was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by the paramilitary death squad. As a young man, he was one of those who chose to become a guerrilla as a way to fight for change and to what he believed at the time was to fight for a better society. He, however, became disenchanted with the discourse and the actions of the guerrilla groups, and he left the guerrilla movement. But 6 years later, one of his ex-commandantes became a paramilitary and started aiming at people that he knew that had been in the guerrilla, and they were killed, they were tortured and killed, including my brother.
Despite the fact that Héctor wasn't politically involved himself, he too was taken into custody and tortured by Colombian soldiers.
It was in 1982. The brother that I just mentioned was camping during that time. It was exactly the week of presidential elections in Colombia, when Trubal Ayala, who had declared the Estatuto de Seguridad, a very repressive Estatuto in the country, like Colombia's version of the Patriot Act at the time. While the country was electing Belisario Betancur, I was in the chamber of torture. My brother was camping with three neighborhood kids. They went to Briceño, a small town in Antioquia, and it was pouring rain, so they decided to ask the local priest for help. Priest heard them talking about the elections, talking politics, and called the police. Police of the town took them as potential guerrillas who were trying to sabotage the election, and then called the army. The army came, picked them up, and that night, the following morning at 4 a.m., came to my barrio, Francisco Antonio Sea, and five military trucks came, one truck with 10 soldiers, came to each house. They ransacked the house, and unfortunately, my brother had hidden a book of internal circulation of ELN, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, and with that, they took me as well.
In prison, Hector endured electric shocks to the genitals, beatings, a near drowning in a bucket of dirty water, and even a mock execution with bullets whizzing past his head. But to better understand Hector's experience, we need to better understand his native city, its geography, its people, its social dynamics. Medellin sits in a wide valley. Its downtown and wealthiest neighborhoods, like El Poblado, line the southern floor of the valley, while a maze of poor and overlapping slums crawl up its northern hills. Adam Isaacson is senior associate of the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., where he lobbies to change the United States' foreign policy toward Colombia. Here's how he described the difference between Medellin's valley floor and hillside slums.
The higher up in the, on the mountainsides you go, the more rustic it gets, and the less likely you are to see running water, and people are more recent arrivals from the surrounding countryside. So, but that's what you see when you're looking up and out toward the edge of the city. If you're standing in the middle of the city, you're in a very modern-looking city. There's art, there's culture, there's the infrastructure is just what you'd expect to see in Mexico City or Caracas, or really New York or Philadelphia for that matter.
Aldo Civico is the director of Columbia University's Center for International Conflict Resolution. He is currently based in Medellin, where he teaches conflict resolution seminars organized by the University of Antioquia. He describes the difference between Medellin's upper-class and lower-class neighborhoods in slightly more anthropological terms.
If you go to Poblado, you have a sense of a city that tries to protect itself from the outside world. It's a lot of gated communities that are very difficult to access. And very difficult to have meetings in these barrios because the tendency of the people is living protected within their homes. The popular barrios are much more alive. The life is in the open space. People meet. There's a lot of music and of course, a lot of people that you can meet and much more alive. And people are very welcoming you. And the little they have, they're very happy to share with you.
Juliana Rincon is a longtime blogger based in Medellin. She is now one of the leaders of the Rising Voices outreach project, Hiperbarrio. She described what it was like to go up into the hills of La Loma San Javier, where Hiperbarrio is teaching young people how to blog and how to publish to the web.
Usually when I, like, in the mornings, whenever I go to school, I take the metro in the other direction. The areas in the north of the city are highly populated. Like, there's lots and lots and lots of people living there. The density is very high, of people who live there. And for the first time, I was actually going the opposite direction of the sea of people. Like, I got to sit in the metro, which early in the morning is quite an impossible feat. And I would see the metro on the other side, and it was just stuffed full of people. And they're all going in the opposite direction to the south. So I got to really enjoy this trip, getting off the metro, walking up the steps to stand in, not even stand in line. I just walk into the Metro Cable and then just sit there and take in the view. And I got to experience sitting on one side of the little cart and looking to the right and then looking to the left and just looking at all the rooftops and through windows, because there are some places where the cable is quite low and you can look in through people's windows and just see how people live in an area that is so different than where I live.
How is this so different? What kind of houses do they live in compared to your neighborhood or one of the wealthier neighborhoods?
My neighborhood is made up of buildings, like tall. There are parks and there are green areas, and then you get some houses spread throughout, and then we have buildings, like tall, I don't know, 10-story or more high, 10 stories high buildings or more. And in Santo Domingo, the area between Acevedo, Popular, Santa Lucia, and Santo Domingo, which is the last stop of the Metro Cable, you have these brick houses that are on the slopes, on these mountain slopes. And at first, it looks like any other working class neighborhood. And as you go higher, it reminded me of those pictures you see of Greek houses or in Pakistan, in these communities in the mountains, where someone's front door is, you access it by going through the roof of someone else's building, and then you're looking up into someone's second story house. It's just houses over houses over houses in this haphazard way. You see people building up, like they have a one-story high house, and then they build on top of it and build on top of it. And there's not much privacy. Like, you would have to walk through someone's garden to get to the front door to your house. And your front door looks out on other people's windows and houses in these, like, skinny alleys. And you share a laundry area with communities. I would see like a laundry sink, which people do not use washers or dryers up down there. They wash clothing by hand. They do have running water, and then they just dry it on the sun, or they dry it like hanging clothing off the windows, or if they're lucky, they have someone else's rooftop right outside their window, and they can hang their clothing out there. And as you get higher, there are more houses and there's more people and there's children everywhere, which was something that amazed me. At 6 p.m. when school's out, you see children, like during the day, these parks, they have parks that go underneath the Metro Cable in some areas and they're empty. I always wonder what was the point of it. And then at 6, I realized I got to see what the point of it was. At that time, they're full. There's children everywhere.
Just 15 years ago, it would have been unthinkable that Juliana or anyone else from Medellin's Valley would go up into the hills. Adam Isaacson.
You know, you could be in the center of town and look up at the hillsides, and you'd be looking at places where the Colombian police did not dare to go unless they went in groups of 30 or 40 or more, because they were in the hands of gangs or sort of the urban militias, which are sort of the urban branch of leftist guerrilla groups, or right-wing paramilitary groups, or narco-traffickers, or a combination of all of those.
Aldo Civico of Columbia University gives us a brief history of how the barrios in Medellin's northern neighborhoods became so violent.
By the end of the 70s, when a youth gang started forming, and in those years, also the cocaine industry started very heavily in the city of Medellin. Those were the years when Pablo Escobar started to dominate with his business the city and infiltrate the city with narco trafficking. And what you had over the decades is basically a following of different kinds of groups who would be always linked to narco trafficking and disputing and competing for control and domination in the city. In the 80s, what you would have is also a reaction to the violence perpetrated by the gangs. You would have the formation of self-defense groups of militias that initially were linked to the guerrillas. In those years, the guerrilla had the plan of taking over power by taking over cities, by controlling cities, and starting by the marginal barrios that are the most poor ones here in Medellin.
But then something profound happened. The killings, they stopped.
It's actually the safest city right now in Colombia. You went from over 300 deaths every 100,000 residents to something like 30.
Adam Isaacson calls it an uneasy peace, alluding to allegations that Medellin's current government has struck a deal with the regional paramilitary groups.
So it's a really strange combination in Medellin right now. This current sort of renaissance the city is going through owes in some part to an improvement in law and order, and in some part to tolerance of the mafia, basically. And it's an uneasy coincidence. But it's right now it's working. It obviously can't work for in the long term. But it's a strange, it's encouraging, but also very strange at the same time.
The decade of peace has allowed Colombia to develop at an impressive rate. Most observers give credit to Medellin's incredibly popular mayor, Sergio Fajardo, a mathematician and son of one of the city's most famous architects. Fajardo is hiring renowned architects to design and construct ambitious modernist libraries and other public buildings in the city's poorest slums. But Aldo Civico says it was Medellin's large civil society that was responsible for Fajardo's election.
Medellin has been a city that over the decades has always tried through a very vivid civil society to lower the effects of the conflict. And so you have a very thick network of organizations, of civic organizations, that have tried to promote a culture of nonviolence, of a nonviolent way of resolving conflict. The election of Mayor Sergio Fajardo was a part of the civic movement, which became free and independent from other specific, particular, and private interests.
And all observers agree that Medellin's metro system has been instrumental in its transformation. Here's Julian Rincon.
Since the late 80s, early 90s, things have been changing. I think, and that's my personal position, that the metro system is one of the most important issues or factors in the change that Medellin has gone through. Medellin is not Colombia's capital city. It's the second largest. And the fact that it has a metro system, which is impeccable, it's clean, it works well, and it helped people who used to have to take three different buses to get to work. Now they only have to travel on one metro, or maybe metro and bus, and they don't have to sit through traffic jams. They can get to work, and they don't have to spend 3 hours of their day just getting down from their house to work, and then 3 hours to get back. And I think that has helped the civilian population, just to feel like a part of the city.
Aldo Civico.
Besides connecting marginal barriers to the center and to public offices and all of that, I think it created strong identity of pride. And they call it here the culture of the metro, because it's a space which is extremely clean, it's a very elegant structure, and there is no crime at all. You have no robberies, you have no assaults, no nothing of that happening in the metro. And everybody really takes care of their metro system so that it remains clean. And it's a really good and safe space where citizenship comes out at its best.
Now, with the metros, and now that people are going to these places and not seeing them as something awful and dangerous, I think things are changing slightly.
In these neighborhoods, the only present, if at all, was the repressive presence of police. Today it's different. There is communitarian police, but there are also other kinds of services in terms of transportation, in terms of schooling, in terms of cultural events that are very important and give another perception of legality in these marginal barrios.
Besides just connecting Medellin's hillside barrios with the valley floor below, the local government has also built a number of what are known as parque bibliotecas at the very center of these poor neighborhoods.
They're called parques bibliotecas, which translates to library parks. And they built these amazing modernist buildings in the poorest and most conflicted areas. Santo Domingo, for example, really poor, really far away, like it gets high up in the mountain. And these libraries are just creating this sense of pride in these communities. The metro itself is creating a sense of pride, just knowing that they are getting something that's nice and clean and beautiful and modern.
Aldo Civico agrees. He says the modernist libraries have reshaped the identities of the surrounding neighborhoods.
Bringing actually institutions like libraries, strengthening education and schooling in the poor neighborhoods, or creating parks, playgrounds in neighborhoods which were always forgotten by the state, has been a very crucial, important part of the strategy, because it gives another sense and another perception of these marginal barriers to their own residents, who, you know, many say, well, you know, we never thought that something like so big and so beautiful could be built in our neighborhoods. And so it stirs up another kind of identity, another kind of pride of living in this area, which have been always depressed and controlled by criminal groups.
Thanks to the Metrocable and the attractive new library parks, Medellin is starting to feel less like a chain of unequal neighborhoods and more like a unified city. Mayor Sergio Fajardo's approval rating is sky high.
His approval rates are above 70%. I think you really have to look at the plan and the strategy that Sergio Fajardo put through in order to understand what's going on right now. The demobilization and reintegration of former paramilitary combatants is just one component of a larger strategy. It's not the only component. And I would say that Sergio Fajardo's administration's emphasis has been very much education. 40% of the budget is dedicated to education.
Part of that investment in education has filled brand new computer labs with brand new computers in Medellin's poorest neighborhoods. And it is thanks to those labs that Julian Rincon, Jorge Montoya, and Alvaro Ramirez are now training young people to document their lives and their communities using weblogs and online video. In the second part of this podcast, we'll look at their project, Hiperbarrio, and how it aims to help Medellin's young people from the Northern Hills create media and not just consume it. For now, I leave you with Colombian musician and blogger Lizardo Carvajal.
Para que no me viera disfrutando de tu dulce desnudez. Mi deseo era mirarte un poco menos lejos, comprando un telescopio 30x largo alcance me compré. Imagino ya tu imagen 30 veces más grandiosa, 30 veces más hermosa, 30 veces más cerca de mí. 10:30 de la noche, telescopio en mi ventana, como siempre allí estabas, pero algo sé que no era igual. Me mirabas con lujuria, pero en prendas menores, tus pechos son más grandes de lo que podía pensar. Yo estaba idiotizado con su cuerpo de modelo, cuando ella gentilmente una cerveza me invitaba a tomar. Pronto sospecharía de su pose congelada, es que eras una valla triste y fría enmugreciendo mi ciudad. Mi dicha era mirarte, contemplar en la ventana, tu silueta blanco y negro como sombra de la China eras tú. Adiós a tu figura de sombras de la China y bienvenida sea la campaña de publicidad. Bienvenida a la triste voz del comercio que nos quita la vista, pero no lo suena.